to Supply Chain Next with your host, Richard Donaldson. Join us as we explore the ongoing evolution of supply chain, from the challenges professionals face every day to the ongoing digital transformation of the entire value network.
All right, welcome to the next episode of Supply Chain Next, and I am thrilled to have Julie Lazo here. Am I saying Lazo right?
It's Lasso, just like Lasso. What a cowboy uses, yeah.
I got Ted all of a sudden now just came to mind. And
of course, I should just reference Ted these days. Right. It's spelled differently. So.
Yeah, it is.
Then I invite that as well.
Absolutely. And thank you so much for joining us here today. And you are
happy to.
Coming in from Minneapolis, which is also my hometown. So I feel a lot of affinity there. But like we kind of start most episodes. Julie, why don't you give us a quick introduction, you know, who you are and kind of where you're from and you know, kind of how you got into where you're, you know, what you were doing. We'll get into kind of, you know, what your career's been like.
Oh, wonderful. Well, thanks so much for having me, Richard. As you shared, I am Minneapolis based, born and raised in Minnesota. Coming out of college, I joined Target Corp, which is headquartered here in Minneapolis, and I still live in the shadow of the bullseye, as it were. And I spent 17 years at Target, and what got me into Target was an inventory analyst position. And I had a couple different opportunities to work within warehouse facilities at a local grocer that's also headquartered in Minneapolis, now called UNFI, or part of the UNFI group. And I've always Byerly's is here. Lund
yeah.
is here.
So well, was that part? I don't remember if that was part of the BNI group or not.
UNFI is
for UNFI. Well, sorry.
UNFI is Super Value is under there, and I don't know.
Right.
I think Byerly's and Lund's are still separate, but they are
separate. Right.
Sourced. Yeah.
And a quick question because you flew over it, and it's also
oh Lund. Please.
Did you when you went to school undergrad and kind of jumped into Target? Did you go to school with the intention of kind of falling into what you fell into? You were kind of getting there, but I want to, because a lot of people who are in undergrad and graduate programs, you know, are seeking to figure out like what led you in the direction you went. And sometimes it can be serendipity or maybe you had a plan.
Yeah, no, I appreciate the reframe there. I went to school for economics and English with a classics minor, and then I moved that over to full economics by the time I graduated. And I kept the classics minor because I studied in Greece. So that was just fun and made that easy. But I think similar to you, Richard, when I graduated, there wasn't a massive retail management program. There weren't these amazing supply chain degrees. So I had more of a business background. I loved economics and I wanted to be able to help others understand economics. I just thought it was a really interesting way that human behavior and money came together to make an economy. So I really loved the concept of it. And I happened to be really fortunate that I got a great job at the Super Value Warehouse, as it was then called, and picked grocery orders. So I
basically
did some of the inventory management. And then I was there for 4 years and was able to build an internship there that was more at a strategic level of how do you manage inventory and work through some of their processes within the organization. And that just married really well to what I was working on in school. And then when I went to apply to jobs, Target and Best Buy and Super Value were all headquartered in Minneapolis, and they all had inventory analyst roles. And that just felt like a really great next step within the corporate space to bring to life what I'd already started learning in the warehouses.
Absolutely.
And so that's how I stepped into it.
Yeah, and I'm gonna double click, and I do this every now and then because when you hit on really cool things. And oftentimes you don't even think about it, but you know, you're talking about inventory management, and that is really an interesting place to start because coming full circle to where we are today, I would contend that inventory transparency through digital twinning is the absolute foundation that we need to digitize our supply chains. Yet you're back at the beginning of your career starting in inventory management, right?
Yep.
And now you kind of fast forward 20 years, kind of reflect on that. I mean, at the time, looking back now, what you know, like, you know, I'm still shocked at how little we can see into our inventories, even at, you know, bellwether companies like a Target or a Best Buy or, you know, my background's in, you know, the high tech world. But, you know, you were kind of at the beginning seeing inventory management and the, you know, both the awe of the ability to even do anything, but also the chaos of how, and I don't want to say mismanaged, but maybe, you know, not as well managed as it could have been. And just, you know, I guess the question really is like, you know, what an interesting place to start thinking where you are now. You know, looking back on that, what were some of the things you think about? What did you see? You know, what kind of helped you guide you a little bit through your tenure at Target?
Well, that's well framed. And when you bring up the concepts of high tech and digital twin, I was very much at the analog stage of that, like literally picking up products and putting them on a pallet and then loading them onto a trailer, a tractor trailer, or semi trailer, to get delivered. And we also had inventory audits. So physical audits, there was almost nothing barcoded. It was all keyed in by a SKU code. It was the black screen, the pine screen with the green font that you were tracking this and that. And we made audits every month for things that were lost. And then
this isn't that long.
This is like less than
20 years ago. This is early 2000s.
Late 90s, early 2000s. It was,
wow.
That was what we did and how we found product and audited. And that was part of my internship too, was standardizing some of that work and the process within the audit. But when you think about the abilities to track and anticipate delays and actually anticipate the gaps in bottlenecks in the supply chain, that wasn't something we were even able to really conceive of. It was like, we need to get these orders out by 6 so that it can get delivered for the overnight crew to be able to fill the stores. Like that was the very narrow scope that we were working within.
Gotcha. So that sort of gets your foot in the door, kind of primes the pump, as it were, from your supply chain career. How did that then progress? I mean, you kind of get into Target, you're an inventory manager. Let's walk through kind of what happened, you know, during Target's years.
Well, inventory management was a fantastic place for me to step into the organization. I was in general merchandise in the home decor area, which had a really fun blend of domestically sourced, but then also internationally sourced products, which was a fun way for my scope to start to change and having different conversations with the suppliers, with our global sourcing team. Target has an in-house sourcing organization that sources products from around the world. And as an inventory planner, I worked very closely with those teams. And you learn very quickly that the conversations that you're used to having around grocery or consumable commodity goods are very, very different from furniture and lighting and wall decor when you're looking to have those products sourced in China, India, countries in Europe. And your expectations can be very, very different. And I would say in my early days at Target, it was still very, very analog in a lot of ways. And I was forecasting with some support, certainly, but it was, I would say, very 2D in a way that today, yep, I think we are 3 and 4D when it comes to analysis. So it was very simple, very straightforward forecasting, very linear is another way to think about it. But it was a great first couple of years within the organization. It was a very typical path at the time. You stepped into that space. A lot of people came in with a perspective on retail, knowing they wanted to be in buying. But I loved the inventory planning side of it and would have been happy to keep that as a career without even knowing that there are so many more opportunities within retail and supply chain that I could pursue.
And how did you, okay, so then again, I think it's fascinating when we come back though, because the inventory management is a key piece to this, but you know, let's walk through, because you spent a good chunk of time at Target, clearly, right? I mean, 17 years is not trivial. And you also kind of came through a period that's fascinating because we're going to get to what you're doing now. But you saw from within one of the greatest, you know, today globally recognized, certainly domestic, you know, brands, Target, mm-hmm, who is, you know, in its own right, very successful, has to at the back end deal with all of these supply chain issues and has done a pretty damn good job, to be honest. Right. But you're also kind of tracking during these 20 years when supply chain all of a sudden becomes the forefront. So you're kind of living within one of these major supply chains, simultaneously growing your career into overall supply chain activity. So kind of walk through that a little bit. Like, how did you progress through Target? And again, there's a bit of, you know, your memoirs here. So these are early notes for your memoir. What did you see within Target? And what was Target as a company evolving towards? Because they've also been a pioneer in a lot of really interesting supply chain activities, and arguably even innovations, and you were in the middle of it. So you, mm-hmm, both as a person were developing a career in a supply chain within a company that has become a supply chain expert. And so the broad question here is kind of, you know, walk through those years. How did your career progress and track against the supply chain innovation that was going on within Target as a company?
I'd be happy to. For me, what I found out at Target early on is that I loved setting up the stores to be successful. And for me, the partnerships that helped impact that were often the global sourcing and the vendor partnerships. So that was definitely a theme that ran through the rest of my career. And there are absolutely, just to make a small aside, some phenomenal merchants, brand owners, people with a very strong creative bent that all play a very critical role in retail. And while I appreciated the roles that they played, for me, it really was more that operations piece that I was so, so passionate about. So as I look back at my career, the roles where I truly just fell in love with the impact that I could have and the work and the colleagues I was working with all have that supplier partnership relationship angle. And so I started certainly in inventory planning, learned a ton with that team, working with the global teams, as I mentioned, both internally and then also the supplier partners. The next role I took at Target was a financial role supporting our negotiations process. So this was a pretty pivotal shift where Target had already internalized their sourcing team, but was now standardizing the conversation around supplier partnerships. And what did it look like to enter more strategic, longer-term agreements with supplier partners of all kinds? Mm-hmm. But we were really integrating a lot of that own brand strategy. So a lot of the Target, if you remember that phrasing from early in the 2000s.
And of course.
It came from those great limited time partnerships with celebrities and the like, but also that's when Target's own brands really started to come into play too. And in that negotiation role, I got to see what that looked like. How do you form those partnerships? And I did step back into inventory planning for one final role as an inventory planner. So I managed a team and led a team strategy, which was so much fun because in addition to, it was in pet care. And it was at the time where we were integrating not just the commodity spaces, but when pets really started to become part of the family. Yeah. And it was common to now buy clothes and Halloween costumes for your pet. So we also built out a more of a general merchandise side of the pet business, which was a shift in the perspective of quick turn commodity goods to now introducing import and long lead time businesses. So that's where I felt like inventory planning really started to shift perspectives when you weren't just solving one kind of problem or addressing one type of needs, but you were becoming much more multifaceted in how you needed to approach inventory solutions. Mm-hmm. And I really got excited about getting deeper in that space.
Awesome.
And so the next step I took was into sourcing that Target's own brand sourcing team. At the time, it was called Target Sourcing Services, TSS. And that role was all about finding the perfect partners for Target. And so the way I thought about it, again, and this is still a very linear concept in my mind, if you have product in the store that's going to be going to the guest, take a step back from that. It's in the distribution center, and a step back from that is from your suppliers. And I wanted to get that further step back into that supplier space. Mm-hmm. And within the own brand space, I was fortunate to step into a role in bedding, which had partners all over the world. We sourced from Portugal, we sourced from Turkey, India, China. And I just loved getting the sense of how you bring really amazing products to life. And that is where I started getting a deeper understanding of the manufacturing processes. Certainly not to present myself as an engineer by any stretch of the imagination. I worked with amazing product designers and engineers, but I was able to learn from them to help understand what the best supplier partners were. And at Target, the business partnerships and negotiations team, the sourcing team's philosophy was around how are you building more value? And that was just a philosophy that I absolutely fell in love with and spent about half of my career ended up being within that sourcing team. But that first foray into bedding was just a delight. I loved that role so much.
Got it. And so, again, I think there's so much going on in there. And one of the things that struck me is you were also bouncing between. One of the things that we also see today is that supply chain, just as a function, number one, has not had good tooling, right? Mm-hmm. You've almost had to kind of build your own stuff. And, you know, they're always kind of the whipping boy. But, you know, I look at SAP, right, which everyone, of course, has. But it was always a financial tool that has tried to be shoehorned into becoming a supply chain tool. And I don't think that worked very well. And I think the market has kind of spoken on that one. But regardless, also organizationally, you were bouncing between kind of inventory management. You talked about sourcing and procurement and then sort of strategic sourcing. So here's a question, you know, looking back in Target as an organization, how did their supply chain organization evolve during your career in the sense that I'm guessing some of those organizations may not have always been in supply chain, or maybe they're still split up. Like I reflect on my own enterprise experiences and some of the sourcing procurement lived in finance, not always in supply chain. Inventory management may have been a better supply chain, but often supply chain was conflated with procurement and logistics, and that's about it. But that leaves a bunch hanging, and you can't look at the whole organization that way holistically. So how did Target kind of, adjust over those years?
When I stepped into the organization, it was very separate. So supply chain really was more of that logistics feel. I think you hit the nail on the head there. And then within sourcing, or that own brand sourcing management, that has always been, or was often, merchant adjacent. So reported up through the merchandising organization with close partnerships in the design and product design area, but never reporting up through that team. And then I'll be hard pressed to say exactly where it lives now, but there was also time where sourcing reported up through planning. Mm-hmm. But supply chain was, I would say, was on its own until some of the more recent iterations. And I would say that's within the last decade has it become much more of an integrated, holistic supply chain planning approach, where that is including inventory and that is including logistics, and the tools and the technology to support that work is simply phenomenal now. Whereas, like I said, back in those early 2-3 roles I have the organization, my perception, and I wasn't sitting in those chairs as directly, was that it was still much more linear. We had one import warehouse and then got a second. Right. And the distribution centers were under 10. And the flexible fulfillment tools that are available now, weren't even conceived of back then in a way that was shared broadly.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's, your direct experience, both in your career development within Target, as well as being within an organization that has had to adjust their supply chains, right? Both organizationally, and then also just prior to prioritization from a planning perspective, right? Like the seat at the table, may not have been often kept for the head of supply chain, but that's changed dramatically recently, right? As people have woken up to how important, the supply chain is literally, like your central nervous system for a company, right? It's the spinal column and then some. And if that thing breaks, everything breaks, right? And it's shocking that people are just waking up to that, even within great, amazing companies like Target, right? I mean, it's not intended to discredit them. It's just to expose the universal nature of this problem, right? That's being addressed across all Fortune 2000s, right? This is not, but they've done some amazing work is kind of where I'm trying to get to. They've led by example. And I think you were in the middle of it. And so it's just an interesting reflection to see that now, especially where you are now looking back in.
Mm-hmm. And I would say supply chain really seemed more like an approach, not a strategy earlier on in my career, that it was the way you were able to deliver on a merchant vision of a wonderful assortment. It was the way you supported beautifully built and designed stores, but it wasn't that strategic nexus that you talked about just a moment ago. And I completely agree that the tools and resources that support that work now are incredibly strategic and central to bringing that guest experience to life, which has always been important. Target's always been about creating an experience that's amazing for guests, but the piece of tactically doing that and getting that product into their hands is now much more centrally found in the supply chain strategy and execution.
Well, I think that, again, you hit on something there. It's also interesting. So you actually asked a question in there. Well, I think it's a question, but is, when do you think things became strategic as far as supply chain is concerned? Because that's a fairly recent phenomenon. And I mean, I kind of feel like it's in the last 5 to 7 years-ish, a few years just before the pandemic hit. And I think, again, it's universal across the board. People are finally realizing that, prior to this, having finance and marketing and sales, those are the people that you typically bring in to kind of beat through the strategy, and just now the supply chain people are being involved, right? But that's, again, recent. So when do you think that shift kind of happened? When did in your experience, did supply chain move from kind of tactical, operational back office to strategic, role?
I think your estimate of around the last 7 years, maybe just earlier than that, would be my perspective on it. From the lens or the chair that I was sitting in at the time, as Target was moving to own more of its own product development work and build out that team, and it was deepening own brands, it was important for Target to get further back into the supply chain. And I think as that happened, and as you were then direct sourcing your own goods from around the world, you needed to build out a more sophisticated approach long before the influence of dot-com was really felt. I think that was when I started to see a shift in this is just beyond, it's beyond just the ask of logistics and filling containers and shipping product on time. It is now a very key piece of making sure that we set the back to college sets on time, or that we're able to very impactfully set our holiday seasons and whatnot. Because again, back to that presentation in the store, the experience that was being built out, Target just wanted to own more of that. It wasn't just about filling shelves. It was about creating an experience, and you need to know and trust that your product is going to be there to do that. And to do that, you need a fully functioning supply chain all the way back to the supplier insights to be able to do that well.
And how, so let's shift a little bit. So, you know, you left, if I got this right, Target somewhere around 4 or 5 years ago, 6 years ago, mm-hmm. something like that, right? Yeah. So it's, you know, kind of pre-pandemic. So what have you moved? What have you evolved into career-wise? Because I think you're doing some really interesting stuff right now, especially building off of that tenure at Target, and kind of, you know, what are you focused on now?
I've really kept that retailer-supplier partnership at the core of the work that I do. And I certainly wouldn't be able to do this work without the experiences that I had at Target. Mm-hmm. In addition to business roles, I was able to move into a strategy and operations role across sourcing organization, which meant that I helped build out capabilities for that sourcing team, whether it was negotiation strategies, matrix development, second tier, first tier sourcing strategies. And through the work on that team, I built out a toolkit of project management and strategic advancement skills that really built out and lent itself well for a consulting space. Mm-hmm. And what I kept hearing from suppliers and some of my friends that were in the supplier space, and that was just that they were having a tough time if they were trying to connect with their retailers. And this wasn't simply just Target. It was other retailers as well. But it started becoming a bit more of a black box of how do you really show up successfully, especially in that own brand and private label space, and do what needs to be done to bring really amazing products to the shelf. And I thought, hey, I think there's something I can do here to help in this space. I've worked on the planning side. I've worked in negotiations. I've worked in sourcing. And I like figuring out ways to bring really amazing products to the shelf. I can do this. This is something that I found really motivating. And when I stepped out of the organization, candidly, I didn't have that perfectly framed out. It took me some time to find some footing in what I wanted to focus on. But what I really work with retailers to do today is help build amazing own brand partnerships. So that's mm-hmm. finding the right partners to work with. That sometimes developing some of the process work, I'm a bit of a process princess, so I'm happy to help create some structure.
Love it, right?
For internal organizations to work effectively, but then also to communicate and work effectively with their external partners.
Yep.
And then the third leg of that stool is all around negotiations. At the time of recording, I don't know if this is going to change in a few weeks or months, whenever someone ends up listening to the conversation. There's just a lot of inflationary pressures around costing right now. So there's a lot of cost of goods conversations, and we're still feeling the after effects of some of those initial COVID shocks too, where certain suppliers aren't as flexible, aren't even available anymore. So retailers are still building up those matrices and reestablishing some partnerships. So that's a lot of the work I focus on. And then the last piece that I'm focusing on is the part of the business I'm building up and I'm so excited about is around the circular economy and how that retailers can use the circular economy as a framework to really approach sustainability and take some of those really impactful steps forwards in partnership with their suppliers to help deliver a more sustainable, have a more positive impact on the communities where they make product, the communities where they sell product. Mm-hmm.
So I'm glad I heard it in there. I'm glad you said it. Because there's always this sort of, you know, reference to linear, and knew we were going to get to the circular. But you key on a couple things here that I also think I want to kind of expand a little bit, which is one, you know, you started where everyone starts, which is, you know, identifying that suppliers, by the way, today are integral to the whole relationship and supply chain. And if you don't have that down, which most people don't, right? No, not getting in anybody. You got to start there, right? And you kind of led that charge, turned that into consulting. However, and this is where I'm kind of headed, you've also keyed on the fact that the suppliers, their requirements have now changed. They have to start thinking about being circular and put as much effort as we, because we spent the last 20, 30, 40, 50, 100, 200 years developing how to source stuff, package it, assemble it. I mean, I'll give IKEA all credit all day long. They even figured out how to make it so that people could build their own and make it simple, assemblable, kind of, depending if you've done it before. But, you know, I mean, it can be frustrating. Yeah. Now we got to take that same energy and apply it to the back end circular nature of this whole supply chain, because it is equally as important now to figure out, well, once I'm done with something, if I'm not going to extend its use, how do I deconstruct it in a way to make everything in there circular, right? Because we clearly are using way more than we should. And oh, by the way, that's evidence. If we look at the 100 gigatons of materials that come out of the ground, you know, that's the Circularity Gap Report. It's a circular economy group out of the Netherlands that ironically tracks against the $100 trillion GDP figure that's running around. But of that 100 gigatons of stuff, 52% is biomass, 48% is materials. You know, and you can see it in these charts and you begin to go, oh, we're only 8% circular, which most people don't know. Mm-hmm. So again, I think you're building a practice that's so timely because you're connecting the dots to create circularity as a strategic imperative of supply chain design that leads with the prototypical sourcing vendor relationship kind of conversation. So a lot in that question, but I mean, how are you kind of framing up that? Because I mean, again, I think you couldn't be better timed. Like today is the time to be doing this stuff. And how are you dealing with the people like Target who have to start thinking circular, as well as their suppliers who also have to start thinking about circular?
Well, and I think it is just that. It's starting to have the conversations. And Target has an amazing sustainability team. They are embracing circular. And where I really show up is for retailers that haven't been able to quite get that footing underway yet. They know it's important, maybe they've even committed to some goals, but they're still trying to understand what's our approach and how do we lead this parade, as it were. Because what I was hearing a lot of, especially when I stepped out of Target, like you said, half a dozen years ago now, there's a bit of the alligator arms, and I know that's not going to translate to those who are listening, but it was the short arms, like, there's only so much we can do in sustainability. Our suppliers really need to own this, or our consumers really need to be more sustainable in their approaches. And what I loved about circularity was that it could put the retailer at the head of that parade, like I said, or in the driver's seat, and bring some of those key partners along with them. And in the partnerships with the suppliers, you touched on it. We worked really hard to create a lot of efficiency around a very linear approach where we take raw materials, make products, and then essentially those products and their packaging just go back into a landfill by and large. Mm-hmm. And how do you start thinking about designing products in a different way? Mm-hmm. And to me, that goes all back to that supplier-retailer partnership and that relationship. And within own brands especially, retailers and suppliers just have a lot of great opportunities to overlap in that space and work collaboratively together to see what circularity makes sense within that design mm-hmm. space. And what I love about circularity, and I know I'm not your first guest on the podcast to be talking about circularity this year, but what I love about it in the retail and consumer goods space is that there isn't one giant waste loop that you're trying to close. Yes, you're trying to minimize the amount of new resources that you use and find ways to keep those raw materials that are used to make products in use longer. But that is going to look different across all types of products. And therein, I find the fun and the challenge in that work is that you can focus within your categories where and how it makes sense. Mm-hmm. So with many retailers, if you're taking first steps, it's often with creating circular products or products that use non-virgin raw materials, packaging mm-hmm. that's used as non-virgin raw materials, and designing those products to either have an extended life or be able to be reused, remanufactured, recycled at the end of their life, and which that applies to the packaging as well. And then supporting that, if you take a step back out further from that, once you move past the packaging and the product circularity, you're also thinking about what are the systems that we are designing into to help support our consumers in making those great choices. So that's labeling, just to make sure the product's clearly able to be labeled. It's investment in recycling facilities and recycling approaches, or organizations like the Loops program through TerraCycle, where you've got a subscription model, where you've got a commodity good that is coming in a reusable packaging, and you use your product, you buy it, use your product, return the packaging, and you get a credit back, and that packaging is then fully reusable. So you can start with the product and packaging, and then you can take steps out to find those systems that help support those decisions at every point along the way that are reducing waste and pollution and creating a circular reuse of those materials.
Right. And again, I love that kind of how you're breaking it apart a little bit, looking at the individual steps, because I think what you just said, there's almost like a stump speech for your prospective clients, right? It's like, here's kind of the 1, 2, 3, 4 steps. It's got to be the same no matter who you talk to, right? At a high level, right? Here's the frame
at a high level
process, right? I mean, what are your process, you know, princess? I love that, by the way. kind of engineering that, laying it out. Here are the steps. You're all going to go through the same thing. But let me ask again here, you know, in that, you know, are there certain examples of, you know, for instance, cement right now is probably one of the vanguards when it comes to circularity, which is, I find to be highly, you know, ironic, but why cement? But they are, they're absolutely an all circular. They're doing amazing work there. Mm-hmm. Where else are you seeing? Because again, circular is still kind of the new thing, right? Where else do you see of all these materials? Because, you know, I think you're also touching on it. It's not just the suppliers, it's the actual raw materials that we're trying to identify, like wood or aluminum or steel or cotton. Like if I just stick with cotton, mm-hmm. in retail, that's like, and I'm just going to make numbers up, that's like 60% of everything, right? So if you just figure out how to make cotton circular, you kind of pick off, you know, this is your 80-20 rule, right? So how are you looking at the actual materials themselves as the ones to target? I'm assuming in retail, actually may span. I mean, plastics are in there, right? Aluminums are in there. Like, how are you kind of breaking that down and working your suppliers based on the materials themselves?
Within hard goods space or soft goods space, non-consumables, you've hit on a couple of the key materials to focus on. Cotton is absolutely one, but I would say from a category perspective, apparel, we've got to get this right. That's it generates a phenomenal amount of waste. I think the stat is that one garbage truck full of clothing is incinerated or landfilled every second. It's stunning how much clothing is barely used, and you just aren't easily able to find a home for it. So yes, it's the idea of how are we finding ways to focus on certain materials, but then from a design perspective, even stepping back from that, how are we designing clothes that they last longer and that they're are easily able to transition to another state of use? So if you are going to resell or reuse an item, how are you able to recycle it? So that if you have a 100% cotton item and you design it a certain way so that the trims are easily able to be removed. So think jeans, for example, denim jeans, if they're 100% cotton and you're able to remove all of the metal pieces that you see on a pair of jeans, then you are able to do much more with that denim that keeps it at a higher state of use.
So Senator, I'm going to jump in on that because you touched on it. And again, I want to connect dots here. So you brought up something that, again, which I think goes back to kind of the question I was asking, which is we've thought so much about the assembly of things to sell them, but we've not spent a second on how to assemble things so they can be disassembled into their piece parts. And I think that to me is the key kind of soundbite we got to work with suppliers on, because they know how to package stuff up. I mean, I'm shocked at how good packaging is, right? I mean, it's astonishing when you really step back and look at how good packaging has become. Right. Even the assembly of things is relatively simple and formulaic, but disassembling, oh my God, that's the new kind of thing. Right. And so, you know, you talk about removing metal from clothing. I heard the exact same thing from the head of supply chain at Goodyear Tire. Right. I'm like, how is rubber not simply recycled all the time? He's like, it's not that we can't recycle rubber. It's that we have all this metal in the tires through the manufacturing process to reinforce them. Immediately, I'm like, we got to look at the procurement process to solve the circular process. How do we find something that is far more easy to disassemble than metal? I mean, my entrepreneur starts going, okay, the problem I'm trying to solve is how do I replace this, you know, metal material in the rubber, or how do I solve the manufacturing process in a way that I can disassemble that very easily, or find an alternative to metal that's easier, that still reinforces the tire, but allows me to disassemble and put it in a circuit. You know what I mean? Like, you got to aim at the procurement process again to say, how do I get to circular? So, you know, I mean, again, you must see that in a lot of other areas too, in the people that you're working with.
Yes, absolutely. It's designing really on two levels. It's designing the products and the systems that the products are going to operate in. And while retailers can't own that entire chain, they have an incredible amount of influence over both the way the products are developed and then the way the products move through a system of any kind.
Right.
What I have loved seeing is working with really amazing designers my entire career in retail, who design the most beautiful products. And then the challenge has come to design those products really efficiently. Yeah. And at a low cost. So it was sized right for the space that it was being sold in. And now there's this new layer of design feats that these teams are being asked to do. And it's for that end use, for that after use cases. And I just sit in a bit of awe because the bar just keeps getting raised on these teams to think about how do you bring products together that not only sell, but are used and end life well, or with a certain amount of minimized impact. And I think it's just really fantastic. I work a little bit with the University of Minnesota. They have a design team there. And I know one of the instructors, or the set of instructors, or some classes that are taking their teams through on circularity. And it's just phenomenal now what new designers are being asked to learn, and designers who are already out in the real world, as it were, are building to the skill sets that they just haven't been challenged in this same way that they have been in the last handful of years to really think about their craft in a different way. And I just am so impressed with the creativity that comes from their work, because clearly that is not the role or the value that I bring to the table. Mm-hmm. But it's so essential in moving the work forward.
Yep. So kind of then now looking forward a little bit, you know, and again, we've kind of touched on some trends. So the work that you're doing specifically today, are you working with both the retailers and the suppliers, kind of connecting all that together? Or, you know, talk a little bit more about specifically what you're doing engaging people.
I mostly sit on the retailer side these days. And the work that I love doing is helping to influence how they're aligning and building their internal strategies, and then how they are then communicating outwards and bringing those supplier partners along. I have certainly done some work supporting suppliers, but on the retail side, I love the scope of that impact that we're able to drive. And that is a lot of what has drawn me to those pieces. And it's just some really great opportunities and clients that I've been delighted to work with.
Well, let's look at that spectrum for a second, because this is also, I think, where, you know, it's important for us as, you know, as thought leaders. You know, you are obviously a thought leader in the space. People look to you for this stuff. You're obviously doing consulting, building around it. But there's also companies that are kind of leading the charge too, right? And cutting through the clutter, like, you know, because every company wants to be like, and this is all the greenwashing, and everyone's just like, oh my God, like, I just want real stuff. Like, give me data. Who's actually doing real things? You know, I'm tired of all the sales and marketing, and, you know, people are just very cynical. I fall into that myself category as well too. But there are legitimately companies that are doing some amazing things when it comes to circularity, especially in the retail space. Is there anybody that comes to mind for you that you would look at and say, oh my God, they're absolutely programmatically doing the right stuff? You know, it could be Target, could be Nike. I mean, anybody else that you look at as really kind of leading the charge from your perspective?
Nike is a really great example. I certainly would call them a retailer today. Yep. In the product design space, though, or as a brand builder, they have been, I think, early to the party when it comes to designing products to be circular. They design with very little waste. They have a program called Regrind, which I want to say is more than a decade old by this point, where the products are designed with little waste, but everything that comes off of the factory floor from waste, and then the products themselves, the shoes themselves that come out of this program, are all able to be reground down. And they turn into like play surfaces. So think like playgrounds or tracks or things like that. And so it's almost poetic, really, that you're able to minimize waste, use an item to participate in sports, and then literally bring that reused material to life in a new way that still creates a lot of value in a new play surface, which just, I think, tells a really great story that embodies why that's important to Nike and how they approach that type of problem solving. So that's an example that I love. Other spaces, we haven't talked about food a ton, but other spaces. So Kroger, I think, is a really great example in the food space of being all in on circularity.
Let me double check on that one, because I think that's an interesting one that you bring up, because, you know, biomass is not one typically thought of in circular principles, right? When I think food, I think, you know, oh, I'm going to go get some wheat and, you know, it's in Cargill, right? Let's go back to Minnesota Company, right? A bunch of wheat traders going on and I'm going to do all this wheat stuff all over the world that's going to get turned into cereal. I'm going to eat it. How is that even circular? You know what I mean? So talk to you a little bit about how you see biomass as having circular principles.
Well, there's two sides of circularity and we could be here for hours talking about it, but there's the mechanical side, which we've spent a lot of our time talking about so far. And then there's the bio side. And that is where like a cotton would live. Anything that's coming from the ground is on the bio side. Mm-hmm. But circularity within the food space, I think, has a mechanical element in packaging, for example. So there's a lot of conversation in circularity around packaging and how do you keep food protected and shelf stable, as well as communicating the value and the impact of the food that you're eating to help make choices and do that in a way that's circular. Yeah. So that's, I would think, probably a straightforward way to think about circularity. Mm-hmm. Within the food itself, there's examples around how are you minimizing waste. So think of coffee beans, for example, mm-hmm. and I'm not a coffee bean farmer. So this is more from study than from experience. But today you strip the berry off of a coffee bean and that berry biomass is just left to rot in the field. And then you sell the beans.
Right.
If you are able to secure that berry or sell the whole berry to an organization that's able to take both the berry and the bean mm-hmm. and create an incremental revenue stream. So you started with the bean and now you have bean plus berry. You've got a secondary value stream that's saving workload because you are now able, that's no longer in your field. So you don't have waste to get rid of in your field and you've taken that waste and added incremental value to it. That those are elements of circularity. And it also has the happy benefit of being able to create a more stable revenue stream for farmers farmers in this space too. And sometimes based on how deep you get in the supply chain, don't have a lot of protection. They can be very vulnerable when it comes to weather, fair prices and things like that. So this idea of circularity and minimizing waste and creating incremental value that can do a lot more than just have a preservation of materials. It can also create some security. So that's a way to think of circularity. And also I would say regenerative. And that's something that General Mills and Cargill, also, you know, two local companies here, spend a lot of time and energy focusing on. How do you actually leave the space that we're working in better than when we found it? How are you recarbonizing the ground? How are you minimizing the pollution or fertilizers that are needed to secure ingredients, whether that's animal or vegetable? Mm-hmm. And so those are also elements of circularity and where you're creating that minimal waste and then using other parts of the ingredients or byproducts in a way that creates value, whether that's a revenue stream value or a nutrient value to the ground, as opposed to just discarding what isn't immediately used to make a Cheerio, for example.
Right. No, I actually think you're spot on too. And I think it's great to illustrate that it's not, you know, the food is just one piece of that supply chain, the apple or the, you know, the Cheerio or whatever, right? But there's so much more that goes into it, the production of it, the manufacturing of it, the boxing of it, the shipping of it, the logistics, right? And then even the throwout, right?
Absolutely.
I got a box of Cheerios or, you know, whatever, Fruit Loops, whatever you got. That plastic bag that's in there, that, you know, how is that being reused? How is that box being reused? Right. I mean, sure, I ate all that stuff and maybe there's some waste food there. And we can talk about composting, which is a whole nother one. But again, we spend hours and I'm always conscious because every time we do this, Julie, an hour goes by in the blink of an eye, especially when you have engaging people like yourself, right, who are really thoughtful about this. So it's amazing. I'm looking at the time. We still got some time, but I do want to get to some more forward-looking things as well, too. So again, biomass, interesting points. But now kind of, again, looking forward, what do you see? Because, again, you're in this sort of higher level. What do you see the trends vis-a-vis supply chain in your space that are emerging over the next few years? Because you're driving some of that, right? You are helping companies to discover this sort of new prioritization of supply chain, of circularity, of having great relationships with their vendors and suppliers, revisiting all of that, using technology to connect all those dots, digital twinning all their inventory management. I mean, you're literally at the heart of driving the new trends that are coming out. So what are you seeing as far as those you work with or even your own self as far as trends kind of coming out the next couple of years?
I think the trend that I see having the most amount of influence still is grounded in transparency. And I wouldn't say that that's 100%. New in 2022, like 2022. But I think the demand for that continues to increase as being driven by a handful of different fronts. One, I mean, the technology is now there to let us know so much more about how products are produced, how they're sourced, how they perform, certifications. There's so much more you can learn by just scanning a QR code on a piece of packaging now that you were never even able to, you might not even occur to you to have asked the questions, but never certainly able to easily access as a consumer. And we have consumers now that are much more interested in learning about the products that they are purchasing and consuming or using than ever before. So we're talking about certainly Gen Y to some extent, but absolutely Gen Z and Gen Alpha. They are going to shop with a phone in their hand, and they are going to know so much more about what they've purchased than you and I ever were able to when we started making some of our own first purchases. And they are more and more committed to using items and having loyalty to companies that align with their personal values. They see themselves as having their own personal brand, and those values that are important to them, they want to align with those brands that they're loyal to. And I think transparency within the supply chain space to me is a very meaningful expression of what's going to be important to them on that journey for them to build those loyalties.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because we are coming full circle, because now I go back to where you started, right? In inventory management.
Mm-hmm.
And everything you just spoke about actually kind of dovetails off of that foundational experience. Everything we're trying to bring transparency to starts with inventory management. What is the raw material? Where is the manufacturing process? How is it moving through? What is it being used for? How am I getting it into circular? And as mundane as it may sound, you know, think about your early days in inventory management when you walked in, they're like, oh, tell us what we have. And you're like, okay, literally it's like a mystery treasure hunt to figure out what's there. I got to pull a bunch of people manually because, you know, Bob or Sue are the ones that know where everything is and it's in their heads, or maybe it's on a sticky note. You know, I mean, if you were really advanced, you had an Excel spreadsheet. What's going on? That could have been a tool, right? But I think about that trend now too, and you touched again, you hit it. Digital twinning is really about digital twinning the foundation, the assets. Where are they, right? And I think that's a huge trend right now, because nothing else will work. AI, machine learning, any of all these other, you know, advanced stuff that people like kind of look at, get googly-eyed over. None of that happens unless we understand where the inventory is and where that's going. And that is still a massive problem to solve right now.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I would add, it's not just where it is and where it's going, but where did it come from?
100%.
And where did the pieces come from?
100%.
And the fact that that's now something that we're able to leverage technology to better understand, and importantly, are able to clearly and succinctly communicate, that's pretty game changing. Yep. I think you get to see behind the curtain in a way that certain people feel very empowered by. And I think it's going to be a big piece of what drives retail and consumerism going forward.
Let's ask a question on that one too, because now that also that exposure, that transparency is going to force companies, even as big and bad and successful as Target is, and bad in a good way, they're badass, I was going to say, but you know, whatever, it's going to force them to realize that they are, as cool as they are a part of the global supply chain.
Oh, absolutely.
Collaboration is required now. Mm-hmm. Where companies used to be and still are ultra secretive and competitive and never want to collaborate, that has to change. No one will solve this on their own. I don't care how cool of a company you are. You have to begin to start thinking of the supply chain as one cohesive supply chain, because Target supply chain can be affected by natural events based on the core supplies that they're going after. You know, if you've got a flood in a certain area and all the, you know, cons destroyed, that affects everybody upstream in the supply chain, if you will, or downstream, looking at it. So collaboration is another big trend. I think you've got to also be kind of dealing with a little bit yourself, right? Like, how do you talk with companies who are used to being, you know, like, oh, this is my supply chain. So no, you're actually a part of a larger one.
You don't own a supply chain. I don't think any one entity owns supply chain. I couldn't agree more. I think that the groups that are most successful in my experience are the ones that have a nice balance of being strategic, directive, but then also curious. Mm-hmm. They're thinking bigger picture. They are building a perspective that they are open and sharing, but they aren't running full steam ahead and just going on their own. I was at a conference just this week and someone told the story of there's a certain supplier came out with a very specific product expectation that they just pushed out to their supplier community. And everyone was just in an uproar. They're like, I'm happy that this is your perspective. There's no way we're going to be able to deliver on this. And it took twice as long to get to the same goal as if the retailer had completely unwound that approach, gone out to the suppliers, gone from a place of curiosity, shared that this is what we want to achieve. Help us understand what it's going to take to get there. So they knew where they wanted to go and they were clear in at least in starting the conversation, but then they had that pause point of curiosity to understand what was feasible and what would it take to help make something happen. And I think the retailers that balance that well are organizations broadly. It's certainly not limited to retailers, but organizations that can think big picture, communicate out, and then have that curiosity moment before moving into implementation. Right. And measurements are the ones that are able to move quickly and often with the most impactful results.
Awesome. Well, I am looking at the time now and you got to wind down a little bit. I'm sad because honestly, I could spend the whole day with you, but tell a little bit. So you're open to networking on LinkedIn. You know, what's coming up to you to sort of balance out the year? Like what's on your calendar for Q4, Q1, as it were, right? What are you looking for? I mean, you talk about conferences. You're an avid speaker now these days. So kind of what are you up to over the next few months? How do people find you? Stay in touch.
Oh, well, LinkedIn, I live on LinkedIn. So it's, I'm sure you'll put it in the liner notes as it were, but it's Julie, J-U-L-I, Lasso, L-A-S-S-O-W. I'm only one on LinkedIn. Connect with me there. JHL-Solutions is where I have a lot of information about upcoming events. I do love to speak at events. Retail partnerships, negotiation strategy, and circularity are the big three things that I love to talk about. Mm-hmm. On any of the sites, whether it's LinkedIn or the website, you'll see either where I've been or where I'm headed. Mm-hmm. And if you have an event, I am thrilled to hear about it. And even if you don't need a speaker, I'd love to be able to attend. Yeah. The other thing that I do that is a lot of fun is I work through a circular simulation where I take a group of people through the idea of how do you make a company both more profitable and more circular. And that's been a lot of fun to work through as well. So if that's something of interest, if you're circular curious, as I like to say, that's often a really good place to start a conversation. So
that's awesome. I think that's the first time I'm really glad you brought that up. That's why I asked these questions. But I mean, the circular model, boy, that's a whole episode onto itself because that is so timely right now, right? To be able to actually demonstrate to a company, if you embrace circular principles, you know, my simple sound bites are you're going to both reduce costs and increase resiliency in the supply chain. Two of your main priorities right now are solved by embracing circularity.
Absolutely.
You have a model that shows that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's awesome. Amazing. All right. Well, Julie, on that note, then I want people to be teased to come find you because they're not going to figure out how to do that. Right. The circular curious can knock on your door and express that curiosity, which is awesome. But thank you so much. This has really been an amazing episode. Really a pleasure talking to you. And I hope you have a wonderful day.
Richard, thank you so much. Same to you. And thank you so much to your audience. I'm excited to hear what they've learned, what they're interested in. And so, yeah, please do reach out and share.
Awesome. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. If you have any comments about this episode or topics on supply chain you'd like us to cover, you can reach us at supplychainnext@requis.com. And while you're at it, check out the Requis platform at supplychain.requis.com. Requis allows you to manage the full asset lifecycle in the cloud while collaborating with your entire value network to buy, manage, and sell your assets. Find out more at requis.com.